You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I got a lot of work on my shoulders, but I'm managing it somehow.
Well, I'm glad that you're letting me get in the way of that, and I'm sure our audience would be glad that you're pausing for our benefit. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Glenn Lowry, an economist, a very well-known public intellectual, host of The Glenn Show, author of the book Late Admissions, which I promise people is unlike any memoir they've ever read before. You and I had a conversation about it some months ago. They can find that on YouTube or in the Non-Zero Podcast archives, but I would say skip the conversation, just buy the book. You won't regret it. Would you agree, Glenn? They should skip the part with me in it and just go to the book?
Well, I think it was a good conversation, as I recall, but hell yeah, buy the book.
Okay. So listen, originally when we scheduled this conversation, we were going to talk about Gaza and Israel and some related free speech issues, speech code issues. Then the Charlie Kirk assassination happened, so we decided to break this into two conversations. So we're going to talk about Charlie Kirk. Go ahead and post that. Then we're going to talk about Gaza, Israel, and so on, and probably post that next week. So as for the Kirk assassination, it's been, I guess, about 4 or 5 days. You know, everyone I know was either surprised or shocked by the Kirk assassination per se. But my question for you is, were you surprised that there was an act of violence of this kind of degree of salience that was partisan in nature, given where the country seems to have been heading?
I was a little taken aback by the intensity of it. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that this guy is an activist and is so important in the MAGA world, is young and he's a devout Christian. He's organized this massive social media mediated universe of young conservative, you know. I think that made it salient. It made it very salient, and it became a window onto some, I think, disturbing features of our contemporary political culture.
Mm-hmm. And what? How would you characterize those features?
Well, Matt Taibbi has a book called Hate Inc. Have you seen it?
I know of it. I haven't read it.
Yeah, I think he puts his finger on this thing. I mean, everybody has to be Hitler or a fascist or mm-hmm. something. I mean, it becomes existential. I mean, you have this environment. Trump can't be allowed to be president. It's an existential event. I mean, that's... So then you get this a kid, Kirk, and he becomes an evangelist. He becomes a kind of embodiment of this thing, and you shoot him dead. I mean, of course, I don't mean that subject, you shoot him dead, to be pointing a finger in any particular direction.
Yeah.
No. Anyway, I didn't answer you. You asked me what I thought were the salient features, and I basically said it's a shocking mobilization. Did you hear what his wife said in her remarks?
I'm not sure.
His work will be carried on. I'm going to see to it. She made a public presentation. Mm-hmm. It was very angry and. You know, your heart wrenched for this woman in this position, at least mine did. On the other hand, it was bellicose. It was, you know, this ain't over.
Yeah. No, there were a number of comments like that. Elon Musk, in addressing some kind of, I guess, a MAGA-esque crowd in England remotely. Did you hear what he said?
No, tell me what he said.
It was something like, violence is coming for you and you better fight back, or something like that. I mean,
no, I think I did see that. I didn't remember exactly how it was worded, but yeah.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that there's a tendency to feel existentially threatened, to see the other party, the other tribe as existentially threatening. The example you gave was kind of left of center seeing right of center as existentially threatening, but it's gone in both directions, right? I mean, do you see a big asymmetry there? Because I think go ahead.
Well, I think Trump is the most powerful man in the world. And I think the election, the kind of the debacle for the Democratic Party, the sense of both triumphalism with Stephen Miller or types running around, and also despair with, grasping at straws. I don't think the hatred problem is just the left hating the right. I read Victor Davis Hanson. He blames it on the professors. He's kind of got this generic a condemnation of where these ideas come from. And this is being linked with the killing of that poor woman, that Ukrainian refugee woman in Charlotte. And
Any ideas in his head at all. I mean, look, I don't know, but he just seemed crazy.
But he's a symbol of something, of the disorder, which has been coddled, lenient judges, rationales being given by the studies departments and so on. You asked me for examples of hatred directed at the left from the right, and I'm trying to give them.
Do you see the problem as fundamentally symmetrical? I mean, like when you go on social media, if you do, do you see the same kinds of inflammatory weapons and misperceptions and intentional sustaining of misperceptions, I would say sometimes, be happening on both sides equally?
You're leading the witness. I think what you want me to say is no, of course not. That I see the undermining of the discourse as being more likely a product of right wing. Trump himself is an embodiment of this. But I don't know that I agree with that.
I'm actually not leading the witness. You're a particularly interesting witness because you've been on kind of both sides of the ideological spectrum. I mean, as you document in your book, you've been on the left, you've been on the right, you've kind of gone back. And currently, I would say a lot of people associate you with a kind of anti-wokeism. Certainly when the Glenn Show really started to gain momentum, partly via the conversations you had with John McWhorter, that was a lot of the vibe, right? And I don't mean that. I don't mean to sound like I'm diminishing it. I mean, you were earnestly concerned about issues of free speech on campus and a kind of oppressive, an intellectually oppressive environment there, and so on. But I mean, so anyway, have I characterized your history more or less accurately? And but I largely just want to say, no, I actually don't. I don't. The interesting thing about you is I don't expect you to say anything in particular. I'm genuinely curious as to what you're going to say.
Okay, yeah, you characterized me correctly as an anti-woke heterodox guy. And, you know, unfortunately, the clarity of those times has faded. And it's not 2020 anymore. It's not mostly peaceful protests, Black Lives Matter, and structural racism anymore. And so, yeah, I became, John and I, kind of voices of reason amidst the you know, kind of anti-racism mania. That's duly noted. But no, I think I don't know what I think exactly, Bob. John and I have this running argument about Trump. He says Trump is the end of the world, and I say he has a plurality of political support. It's a big country. There's scores of millions of people who are enthusiastically embracing this. The question is, what's up with that? Not, you know, a personalization of this thing. Mm-hmm. So I disagree with Andrew Sullivan and others about the thing. I think the right are, you know, he said there were good people on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, on both sides of the debate about whether or not you take down a Confederate statue. Not on both mm-hmm. sides of the debate about Jews will not replace us. He didn't say that.
I know. I actually wrote about that. I mean, it's interesting. There's a little bit of a tangent here. The precursor of my newsletter, the Non-Zero newsletter, was called Mindful Resistance. It started at the beginning of the first Trump administration. And by mindful resistance, I meant fine to resist Trump, but don't overreact. Be deliberate and careful. Think about it, including, as you just suggested, think about why he became a phenomenon. What are the grievances that underlie support for him? And, you know, I have since written, I think this was after it became a Non-Zero newsletter, but I've written about the very event you're talking about, Charlottesville. And look, I'm left of center, but it was misreported by mainstream media. If you look at what he said, he did say, right after saying there were fine people on both sides, he said, I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis whom I condemn, whatever, unequivocally, or something like that. It was clear, and I did a piece on how the New York Times covered it and what he actually said. And what I'm really working around to is that, you know, I think, first of all, almost nobody on the left knows that or thinks that the New York Times or anybody misreported this. Everyone in MAGA knows that they misreported it. And it's an example of a reaction to Trump. I mean, that kind of coverage in the New York Times, it's an example of a reaction to Trump that I think ultimately was not helpful for the resistance because it only inflamed the people on the MAGA side. And it seems to me that in general, in these many years of growing polarization running up to the Kirk assassination, you see on both sides what they're doing in reaction to each other that are just making things worse. You just see the positive feedback cycle. The this kind of reporting in mainstream media is one example. Another example I see right now on the right is to look at this assassination, which, for all we know, so far at least, is one crazy guy. I mean, loosely speaking, he had an ideology that I think that he thought he was serving, and it looks like it was a left-wing ideology, but still obviously kind of an unhinged guy. Almost nobody actually ever plans to assassinate anybody, and so far as we know, he's acting alone. And yet, I'm sure you've heard a number of people in on the MAGA side talking as if this was like orchestrated, or this guy speaks for millions and millions of people in some sense. And I'm sure he has supporters. I'm sure there were some people who expressed glee, but this is something I see too. The other side, and social media encourages this, both sides, They'll look at something done by one extremist. And of course, social media always puts the spotlight on the extremists from each side. And they attribute the view or the act to a much larger group of people on that side. At this point, I'm just doing stream of consciousness. But the point is, anyway, where we left off was your point about Charlottesville. And it just seems to me like there is this positive feedback cycle. Both sides are actively involved at this point, and I'm just concerned that there may not be a way back.
Well, it would appear to me that a way back would require leadership, and I'm not sure where that would be coming from at this point. Certainly not from Trump himself, who's blaming the left and doesn't inspire. I say this despite everything that I had said just a moment ago. I mean, he was elected. He does have a following, but he doesn't inspire confidence as a kind of a grave, for the ages, sage, elder, wise person who can guide the country through this treacherous pass. But I want to question the validity of the, is it more the left or the right? I mean, even if it were more excessive on one side or the other, you still need two to tango. Mm-hmm. So they're feeding on each other in a certain sense. And I mean, neither side really does it concedes the legitimacy of the other.
Yeah. No, it seems to get worse and worse. In terms of leadership, when I saw this guy, Cox, the governor of Utah, Spencer Cox? I was not aware of him. But when I just saw him talking at the press conference, I thought, look, if this assassination elevates his profile within the Republican Party, that will be one good thing that came out of it. Because he seems like a grown-up. I mean, he doesn't. He's not maybe giving exactly the message I prescribe, but geez, he just seems like such a breath of fresh air. Yeah. You know, even though he's blaming leftist ideology, and I'm left of center, and I guess what I would I wish he might have more often said, this guy seems to have been in the grips of leftist ideology, but of course he could have been in the grips of far right ideology. People on that side have committed crimes. I'd like to hear a little more than that. But basically, he just seems like a sober, reasonable person who would like to have a healing message. And, you know, lately, these are not the kinds of people who have been elevated in the conversation, really on either side, but certainly not, I would say, in MAGA land.
I like what I've heard from the governor of Utah. I was going to say, Bob, I'm thinking of Russiagate. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of two impeachments. I'm thinking of Nancy Pelosi tearing up her copy of the State of the Union address on national television.
Yeah.
I'm thinking they tried to kill him. I say they with quotation marks around it.
Right, right.
In Butler, Pennsylvania. And a lot of people were sad that the shooter missed. And I'm seeing the Kirk assassination in the context of this. He is, as I say, this fair-haired boy, this kind of a wunderkind of the movement. And he's gunned down in cold blood, shot in the neck in a, you know, whatever, in the most gruesome way on live television. You can see the bullet going in. And I'm trying to imagine myself being one of these dyed-in-the-wool MAGA types. Mm-hmm. The thought that they're after me, and you ask me to split the difference and don't Democrats get shot too, wouldn't move me in the least. And especially mm-hmm. given that the main organs of cultural articulation are 7-1 biased against this guy. I'm talking about Trump. So, I mean, let me put it this way, Bob. I wonder how you react to this. He's a historic figure in American politics. He's perhaps the most important president of my lifetime. I was born in 1948. He's the most powerful man in the world. They call him a clown. again, I'm trying to imagine what it feels like to be a supporter of Donald Trump who witnessed Charlie Kirk get gunned down. That's not okay. That's not respecting me. That's not, I mean, so I'm against the racial reckoning of the George Floyd thing. So I'm against the transgender thing. So I'm a Christian. And I pray. I believe in God. I go to church. I read the Bible. I admire Charlie Kirk's Christian walk. I don't get no respect in the halls of cultural power in this country. I'm alienated. I'm angry. I'm resentful. I'm mad as hell. And then you kill this guy?
Yeah.
So, I reiterate.
And we should emphasize that everything you just said was in the voice of an imagined MAGA supporter, because I know you left the church. So, like, no, that couldn't be you when you were...
No, I'm channeling it. I'm trying to feel it.
I will say, in terms of insults of Trump and so on, I think it's fair to distinguish between Trump 1 and Trump 2. As I said, during the first Trump administration, I had this newsletter, Mindful Resistance. I saw all this overreaction, including Russiagate. I said, look, we don't know. I haven't seen a smoking gun. You're just going to look like a fool if we get to the end and there isn't a smoking gun. Just for now, let's just be agnostic about it. But tons of people went overboard and did look like fools in the end. That said, he, to me, this time around, is genuinely a much more menacing figure in the sense of threat to democracy, to the republic. He's pushing the envelope in terms of centralization of power as fast as he can on as many fronts as he can. And I think that's one thing that's happened is that he's a different guy. I mean, he has filled his administration with loyalists this time. He's not going to be a prisoner of the establishment this time. And he, I think, has no respect for the norms that a lot of us think have been important in keeping this a liberal democracy. And I'm genuinely worried. Okay. What worried me last time around was the overreaction to him, because he didn't seem to me yet like a genuine threat. And honestly, I think if there hadn't been the overreaction, he might not be president right now, but he is. And I just do want to say, I don't think you're crazy to be worried. And I myself have said things at least as insulting this time around as this guy's a clown. So anyway, that's just my thing.
Well, I was trying to devil's advocate against my own argument and envision what people would tick off, ICE mobilization, the tariff thing where he uses a phony emergency power claim to start setting tax policy. The judge who says, turn the planes around, and he basically says, fuck you. I mean, you know, many other things besides. Lack of, you know, firing the Bureau of Labor Statistics commissioner, you know, it's kind of willful flouting of power and disregard for precedent. I was trying to imagine what the other argument might be. And yeah, he is pushing against the boundaries on a number of fronts. The independence of the Fed. So we've got a Department of War now, not a Department of Defense.
So that was mainly just a full disclosure thing. So I want to, as you know, I called your attention to something that I'd like to let people hear. This thing that Charlie Kirk said about affirmative action. Did you have a chance to listen to that? I can play it now.
I did. I saw.
And I want to me, it illustrates both sides, well, two different dynamics, both of which are problematic, one of which in this case is coming from the left, and the other is, I think, coming from Charlie Kirk. And I want to emphasize before I say this, and you may have a totally different view of this, and that's why I want to hear what you have to say, that obviously, you know, if I just want to distinguish between explaining why things happen, the issue of why things happen, and the issue of culpability, you know, to say that there's anything, including maybe something that came out of Charlie Kirk's mouth, that increased the chances that this assassin would commit the crime he committed, to say that is not to absolve him of blame. He's the guy who did it. He's the criminal. Charlie Kirk did not deserve what happened to him. But I do want to, I want to play something where I personally think, on the one hand, I think what he said was symptomatic of a lot of kinds of things that a lot of people say now that is not that helpful. On the other hand, it was misrepresented by on social media. And I think that's part of the problem. So the misrepresentation is, so this is like a tweet. And whoever tweeted it, and it now has 17,000 retweets, 59,000 likes. And this person writes in quotation marks, attributing this to Charlie Kirk, quote, "Black women do not have brain processing power to be taken seriously. You have to go steal a white person's slot." Now, as you know, that's not exactly what he said. Again, I'm not a fan of what he did say, and we can talk about that. But
why don't we see what he did say? So that
Okay. So here we go. Whoops.
Joy Reid and Michelle Obama and Sheila Jackson Lee and Ketanji Brown Jackson were affirmative action picks. We would have been called the racist. But now they're coming out and they're saying it for us. They're coming out and they're saying, "I'm only here because of affirmative action." Yeah, we know. You do not have the brain processing power to otherwise be taken really seriously. You had to go steal a white person's slot to go be taken somewhat seriously. Play cut 52.
"But I rise today as a clear recipient of affirmative action, and particularly in higher education. I may have been admitted on affirmative action, both in terms of being a woman and a woman of color. But I can declare that I did not graduate on affirmative action. This is my personal story."
I hear because of action affirmative. She can't even say that. We know. It's very obvious to us that you were not smart enough to be able to get in on your own. I couldn't make it on my own, so I needed to take opportunities from someone more deserving. You know, this is how arrogant Joy Reid and Ketanji Brown Jackson and Michelle Obama and Sheila Jackson Lee are. They're so narcissistic, they think this is persuasive. They think we're like, "Of course, that's why we need affirmative action, because you have impressed us with your brilliance. Of course. Oh, no. Imagine the world without Joy Reid. Imagine the world without Sheila Jackson Lee or Michelle Obama or Ketanji Brown Jackson. They think this is persuasive. They think, as they kind of now reveal that I'm only here because of anti-white, anti-Asian forced discrimination policies that turn me into a bitter, resentful activist that hates white people, honestly, through our pop."
Okay, so that's the entirety of the
clip. You know who that reminds me of? You know who that reminds me of? That reminds me of Rush Limbaugh.
Huh.
Almost the tone of voice, the rhythm, the ridicule, it reminds me of Rush Limbaugh.
Would he have said those things? We know you listed four black people and said, "We know you do not have the brain processing power."
It was ugly. What he said was ugly. It was ungenerous in the extreme. It was disrespectful. It was contemptuous and contemptible, a person could say. Um, But I don't think it was racist, Bob. I think that's kind of what I'm being asked here. And I certainly don't think it's the kind of thing you can say, see there, a guy who says something like that shouldn't be surprised if somebody wants to shoot him. Because there's more than a grain.
I don't mean that.
No, let me just make my point. There's more than a grain of truth in what he said. That's what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. The affirmative action regime, and I'm not just talking about the preferences that are given to at the expense of some, quote, more meritorious deserving candidate. I'm also talking about the self-justifying denigration that people enter into as they attempt to legitimate the regime. I am proud to announce that I'm affirmative. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for affirmative action. Have they got any idea what they're saying? They're licensing a guy like Charlie Kirk to say, yeah, because you didn't have the chops. They assume the narrative is going to be the institution needed prodding in order to break down barriers that it was unwilling to acknowledge and allow a meritorious person like me to enter. But that's not persuasive. That's not persuasive at Princeton, where Michelle Obama went, that the institution needed prodding to open its doors to someone from the South Side of Chicago. I've actually read her undergraduate thesis. It's singularly unimpressive in sociology at Princeton. It's on the web. And the reason it's on there is because Charlie Kirk has got a point. Anyway, I'm saying affirmative action is corrupt. I'm saying it engenders resentment. I'm saying it invites ridicule. I'm saying there was a contradiction in saying I'm an affirmative action baby, but you better not think I'm less qualified than anybody else. So I don't like his tone. I he's naming names. I think that's unseemly. He's basically calling people stupid. I mean, Michelle Obama has done pretty well for herself in life. I hate that Black people are in the position of having to whine and cry and go screaming from the room when someone points out that we are relying on special dispensation in order to be included in the most competitive venues. The year is 2025. Look at what these Asian kids are doing. Changing our lives, making our society for the 21st century, among others, of course. But I mean, that is what the game is really about. And to be in this position of, oh, Charlie Kirk, you know, Ketanji Brown Jackson, God bless her, is a justice of the United States Supreme Court. She was done no favor when the president of the United States basically announced that he had a Black woman quota at the U.S. Supreme Court. That's the Supreme Court. Now, I don't know anything about the law. She has to labor under the knowledge that every opinion she writes is going to be examined to see whether or not it measures up. I wouldn't want that pressure. I've had it. I wouldn't want it. Anyway, that's what I think. I mean, you touched a nerve with me. I think.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, yeah. I touched the nerve about your view of affirmative action, and which tells me, although you kind of denounced in a certain sense, if not what he said, the way he said it. You weren't.
It was nasty, no doubt about it. It was hurtful. Yeah. I mean, and it was probably intended to be hurtful.
Well, that's what bothers me about that. That's what I think is symptomatic. Again, in this one like social media post, I see on both sides, the person on the left who posted it and Charlie Kirk, things that bother me. With Kirk, it is the fact that we're living in an environment, partly just because of the technological infrastructure of discourse, social media, and so on, where it's very easy to build a big following by appealing to some of the less noble parts of human nature. In this case, I think he must have known that some people, as he said, that the racism button was being pushed and they liked it, right? Like he was not that far from saying, you dumb N-word. and that some of the people who resonated to what he said would have liked to hear that. Maybe I'm being too cynical. It seems to me you have to be pretty naive not to realize that of all the people who are responding positively to that, although some, as you did to the extent that you were positive, are responding to the substance, others are responding for let's just say, much less noble reasons. It happens on both sides. You know, both sides appeal to fear. Both sides appeal to a kind of bigotry. Sometimes it's about like rednecks in middle America. And a lot of times it's a dog whistle and they don't say it explicitly. But anyway, that's one thing that bothers me. The other thing is, again, the person who quoted him misquoted him. He did not say, quote, black women. And there is a difference. That would have been a flatly unabashedly racist statement, in my view. He didn't do that. And, you know, my wife, when I said this to her, she said, well, the lady who posted it isn't a journalist. And I thought, but, you know, in the social media age, in a way, if you're going to go on social media, you inherit the responsibilities of a journalist. Social media is this very influential thing. And any given person can suddenly be communicating with 100,000 people. So if the reason we expect clarity and honesty from journalists, and I'm not saying we always get it, but if the reason we expect it or ask for it is that they're influential, then, it seems to me we all of us who go on social media should think of ourselves as journalists and try not to distort what people say. And that happens on both sides, too. God knows. I see it on the right all the time. Quoting something somebody supposedly said, you watch the video, they didn't say quite that, and the difference matters. So.
I'm thinking about taboos. So what he said broke a certain norm about civility. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I'm thinking that there's a reason for the norm, and it is to discourage the kind of fever swamp, titillating kind of energy that you are fearful that he was playing to. I don't know that he was purposefully playing to that kind of energy, but I would concede that that is what you're going to get. When you say something like that, a lot of people are going to be thinking exactly the thing that he didn't quite say, but that he was misrepresented as saying. But he invited that in a way by talking outside of the norm.
Mm-hmm.
I just published a little book called Self-Censorship, which is a reprint of an old essay of mine together with some commentary. The essay is about self-censorship and about the taboos and the social constraints that we have on what we can say based on the idea that the only kind of person who would say something like that is a kind of person whose values, which I cannot directly observe, must be unsavory. And it creates all kinds of different dynamics. So people will be punished for saying things that are true. I got on the plane, the pilot was black. I know they have affirmative action, and I had a worry, a small thought in the back of my mind, just like if there were a bunch of obvious Middle Eastern people sitting in the first class section of the airplane as I walked past. A thought went through my mind, but you can't say that. You're not supposed to say that. And then someone comes along and says it, you know, and just like the emperor has no clothes, you feel a sense of exhilaration and empowerment because finally something is being said that, you didn't want to have said. So, yeah.
Yeah, but although there's a way of making the point that one downside of affirmative action is that people are going to make judgments like that and say, I don't want to go to that doctor because I'm not sure he got into medical school on grounds of merit. I mean, there's a way of saying that that isn't the way we just heard. Now, again, I'm not.
But it's ridicule. We've been at this for 50 years now, you know.
I know. It's a fine line. But anyway, the generic thing that bothers me is that, you know, when people on the left, they see this tweet and they either accept the quote as written, and I've run into somebody who quoted it to me who hadn't bothered to watch the video, said, did you hear what he said about black women? So it works like that. Or people who watched the video and were maybe less outraged than they'd be if he had said what he was quoted as saying, but still were outraged, then they themselves get into a mindset where it's easier to push their buttons by saying something outrageous, you know, like generalizing from Charlie Kirk. See, they all believe this about black people and want to do that. It's just what bothers me is the positive feedback cycle.
Yeah, but I think that's also 20th century. I think we're past that. Do you ever watch Joy Reid? Have you watched Joy Reid?
Not much.
He plays the race card on a daily basis. Her presumption of racial entitlement and assumption of the fact that everybody agrees with this is insufferable. I mean, mm-hmm. I can see being a Charlie Kirk devotee and catching some of her commentary, some of which I think could also be accused of being racist, anti-white racist. And I hear her taking down a notch, you know, who would miss Joy Reid, and thinking, yeah, right on.
Yeah, I heard you laugh during that part when he said, like, yeah, as if we couldn't get along without whatever he said about Joy Reid. I heard you chuckle. The you know,
Bob, the problem is deep. Claudine Gay, president of Harvard University, is deposed by Christopher Ruffo and Company.
But that's our next conversation. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah.
No. Go ahead and say what you're going to say. Mean that.
I'm just saying, yeah. In some sense, you're the president of Harvard University. You know, you're a kind of in the upper echelon in the hierarchy of esteem for the academic excellence and exquisite erudition and all that. Of course, you're an administrator. It's just the day-to-day job. You're just a president. But it's symbolic. When Larry Summers became the first Jewish president of Harvard University, I think people felt a lot of pride. And I think it's an interesting comparison. I mean, a lot of people hate Larry Summers' guts for a variety of reasons, but there's no denying that he's a distinguished economist. He's a very distinguished economist, had a stellar academic career long before he became Robert Rubin's right-hand man and ended up being Secretary of the Treasury and went to Wall Street and made a lot of money in investment banking and everything like that. Larry Summers is a world-class player in his field. Claudine Gay, not so much. People notice. To get deposed for plagiarism? It's humiliating. I'm just going to say that as an African-American, a prideful African-American. I can't hide behind the assumption that nobody is noticing or that they can't speak of it even if they do notice. That's not very good protection against the humiliation of people underperforming at the highest levels of requirement. So, you know, then a guy like Kirk or a comedian comes along and says they're not qualified.
Let me just say one more thing. First of all, like, you know, that clip of Kirk was taken from, you know, I guess God knows how many hours of footage. That was like on his show. And he was doing a rant. I have done rants and I don't generally plan them. But when you feel there are people out there resonating with the rant, you can go farther than you might have realized you were going to go. So I just want to acknowledge all that. I'm not trying to indict him for this, but what I would say is what worries me about the time we're in is that because it's so easy to do rabble rousing, because social media and independent media and podcasts make it so easy, you know, one way this is sometimes put, and I want to move, this is going to lead to a question to you, is that there are no longer any gatekeepers the way there were when, as you and I remember, there were three TV networks and so on. And one thing that worries me is that because extreme rhetoric is rewarded and there is a strong incentive for it, we've gotten to a place where what we need is the opposite. We need exemplary self-restraint on the part of influential people to speak clearly and soberly and say, you know, without unnecessarily appealing to the base instincts of people. So we've gotten to a place where we need that, and yet the system continues to incentivize the opposite. And that is what worries me. Now, the question I was going to ask you, although you can comment on that if you want, is we've heard a lot of, I've heard some comparisons with the 60s. You know, there was in one year, Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King were both assassinated. And one thing about you and me is we're actually both old enough to remember that. I was, you know, I was a kid in 68, but I remember it very clearly. I was wondering, I mean, first of all, again, feel free to comment on what I had finished saying, but I was wondering what you think of the parallels people are drawing between the kind of unrest and tension we're seeing in the country now and the kind we saw in the late 60s and early 70s.
I think it's overstated. I think the 60s were much more radical. And I mean, I was in Chicago. I was 20 years old in 1968. I remember Watts, 1965. I remember Newark. Mm-hmm. I remember Detroit. Mm-hmm. I remember in Chicago, 1968, April of 1968, the long hot summers, the Kerner Commission, the Black Panthers, the Symbionese Liberation Army, although that was the 70s. But I remember the Weather Underground. I remember bombs going on. I remember Kent State when National Guardsmen opened fire on college kids. Mm-hmm. I remember the culture. I remember, you know, the kind of, you know, themes that got taken up in popular culture. And the last poets, Rapped and Bit My Sister Nell and Whitey's on the Moon. This was what he put out after the moon landing. You know.
playing golf, no less. Remember the guys playing golf on the moon? It's like a country club. But anyway, go ahead.
Malcolm X, who was killed in 1965. The Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. The Nation of Islam was big in Chicago. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, they were somehow more present in my consciousness as a young kid going around in Chicago than I imagine they would be in anybody's mind today. But it was the 60s. It was we're not there yet, not by a long shot.
So you would say that scene, you think that was a more perilous moment in American history than we're at now?
Yeah, I do.
Well, that's encouraging.
I mean, J. Edgar Hoover and the COINTELPRO stuff and the Vietnam War. You know, yeah, it was different, wasn't it? It just feels to me in recollection much more intense. The draft, much more disquieting than now. I can't imagine civil disorder collapsing, although. Civil order collapsing, I should say. Overthrow the government? I don't know if anybody's seriously talking about that.
No, I mean, if they are, they're deluded. I mean, there are people who worry about the opposite, of course, the government, you know, Trump becoming, you know, seizing power in a way inconsistent with the Constitution. I mean, it's funny, the 60s, again, I was a kid, but in 1968, my father was in the military. We moved to San Francisco. The Presidio was a military base then. So the next 3 years, 69, 70, 71, I was in San Francisco and living on a military base, you know, when Vietnam was kind of the main grievance in a way.
Haight-Ashbury was right around the corner.
Haight-Ashbury, man, it was so wild. It was so wild. And what an interesting experience. Also, I'd never gone to school in an urban setting. You know, I went, although I lived on base, I went to San Francisco Public Schools. Look, I mean, they were not ghettos, but I just, the whole idea of an asphalt playground freaked me out. You know, like, where's the grass? But it was wild times. I mean, the Black Panthers, I remember, at least according to what I was reading in the papers, they were handing out, they had a breakfast program for kids where, as reported in the papers, if I recall accurately, they were handing out coloring books. And one of the captions in the coloring book was, "The only good pig is a dead pig." These were like for kindergartners. I definitely had a sense of things kind of coming undone. That's true. Now, on the other hand, because Vietnam was such a big part of that, just ending the war did a lot to deflate the tension, right? Because, you know what they say about Americans and foreign policy? Nobody cares about it unless Americans are coming home in body bags. And they started coming home in body bags in the 60s, and that did a lot to animate the protests. And then when that stopped, 1973 or whatever, you just, you know, the wind, the air kind of came out of the whole thing. So we had said, there's should we leave it here and call this one a wrap and move on to the second conversation about Israel? And because I know you're busy. Okay, so thank you for this. Thanks everybody for listening. You should check out the Glenn Show. And once you've exhausted all the content there, you might check out the Non-Zero newsletter and buy Glenn's book, Late Admissions. And then what's the little book you just referred to?
It's called Self-Censorship. Okay. And, you can find it anywhere.
Okay. So that, probably about a week after this conversation is posted, you'll see the conversation we're about to tape, which is relevant to self-censorship. It's about Israel, Gaza, speech codes, and so on. So thanks so much, Glenn.